Blog Talk Radio.
This is JJ Bomber. You are listening to Well Armed Radio.
Good evening, sheepdogs. Welcome to Well Armed Radio, where freedom is our best friend. Thank you for joining us in our weekly, vigorous, relentless, and typically ruthless pursuit of freedom. We are broadcasting live from the Very Well Armed Studio in New Berlin, Wisconsin. Always my pleasure to speak with the most informed gun owners in the state. That would be you guys. You are your community's finest. With a face for radio and a voice for silent movies, my name is Nick Clark. I am the president of Wisconsin Carry and the host of Well Armed Radio. Also proud to say that I'm the smartest guy in the room. I mean, I happen to be the only guy in this room here, but that's a minor detail. I encourage you to be a part of the show with commenting in the chat or by calling the studio number here, 563-999-3787. You can also comment on the Well Armed Radio MeWe page. There's a link to tonight's show. It's the top post on the MeWe page. That's MeWe.com/P/WellArmedRadio. And the first post is the post for tonight's show. And if you comment there, I'll see it. Hopefully. I'll try to keep an eye on that. Otherwise, we'll jump in tonight, February 21st. We're almost the end of February. You know, this, excuse me, had no snow for Christmas. And I don't even know if we had snow. I think we might have had snow earlier in the winter, like maybe late November, early December. Can't remember for sure. But we then lost it and then had no snow for Christmas. And I think the first week of January was snow-free too. And I remember commenting, and it wasn't that cold either. And I remember commenting to people that maybe it's going to be a super mild winter. And then boom, we get all the snow that we needed to catch up to our normal and then some. And then we had a cold blast for about 2 weeks. So all in all, you know, typical winter. I'd say maybe, I think it's slightly above average for snow. We certainly got a ways to go yet. It's snowing right here now in southeastern Wisconsin. I'm in the New Berlin, I've obviously said that in the intro. I'm in New Berlin, so it's, I don't know, maybe a half inch of snow we've gotten so far. I don't even know what we're supposed to get tonight. See, this is the kind of snow where if this was November or early November, they'd be making a big deal. They'd have press coverage. And when I say press coverage, I mean wall-to-wall coverage. They'd probably have the what do they call it? The shrink panel where you shrink down they press the news broadcast to smaller so they can run the little sidebar thing on it. They'd be out there interviewing the Waukesha County. They do this every year. They go out to the Waukesha County or the Milwaukee Public Works Department, interview plow drivers, the director of public works for it's so clear. I mean, it's not cliche, is not the right word. It's so predictable. So predictable how they do it with this, just the fake news coverage. And then truth be told, though, I mean, I'm to the point where I watch so little news coverage anymore. When I say news coverage, so little network news. But before I start talking into that, we'll get into tonight's show. Well, I guess I did an introduction. So, I think I started the show with the usual warning, no sacred cows here. Pretty sure. If I didn't start the show with the usual warning, no sacred cows here. And I don't watch, I just can't stand it. I can't stomach watching. I used to love watching the news. Really, the only part I couldn't stand was sports. And I would watch anyway. It's the end of the broadcast and whatever. But now, I mean, just news is just saturation propaganda. When I talk network, I don't have cable. I mean, there's so much crap on TV. Why the hell would you pay for that? But so I don't have cable. I would just watch network news over a high def over the air antenna. Milwaukee Channel 4, NBC affiliate, Channel 6, Fox affiliate, Channel 12, ABC affiliate, and Channel 58, which is CBS affiliate. And then you get all the digital channels in there too. But I used to watch a lot of the local news. That's much more interesting to me than some dumb sitcom or whatever. But I couldn't even fathom that. Even the local news. And it started with last spring about this time with Coronanoia. Because last spring about this time, there was a week or so earlier, there was not even a confirmed case in the state. But there was press saturation coverage on the local network news. First 12, 13 minutes of the show, saturation coverage. Coronavirus, coronavirus, coronavirus. It's never been like that before. Even for swine flu back in 2009, did reports on it after it was a thing. But when this thing was like nothing, it was just saturation coverage, which, and again, my belief is, and I think this is supported by lots of information that's come out. Project Veritas talks has done reports on these things. The network executives, they have conference calls. Now, CNN has their conference call with all their, satellite offices, affiliates, whatever. And I guarantee that your NBC, your CBS, your ABC, the national network news executives, I guarantee that they have some kind of communication system, whether it's a video conference call, a group call with their local affiliates, and they talk about the angles that they want to push. I mean, there's no other way to explain how the same talking points get spit out so quickly. Same day, it's not like they watch each other's news broadcast and the next day they copy, because these all come out the same day at the same time on multiple networks. So, I mean, it's clear the liberals have, and you've seen some of this revealed recently in Time Magazine. Time Magazine did that expose on the election and how the Democrats saved democracy with the election, which was really a blueprint of, well, not a blueprint, but a synopsis, summary of how they stole the last election. And they're proud of it. I mean, I talked about that in the show. I think other TV talk or TV, other real talk show hosts, like on WISN and others, they talked about it. That Time Magazine piece came out a few weeks ago. But so for liberals, like nothing happens by accident. They have coordination and coordination is not even a strong enough word. They have coordination and conspiracy isn't exactly the right angle I'm looking for either, but they have a level of coordination, level of orchestration and coordination that we can't fathom. I mean, liberals, they're masters of government. And that's the thing. When a liberal gets in office, they can do what they want to do because the majority of people in government, state and, local probably too, but for sure state. Look, Scott Walker becomes governor, and he's the governor. He has appoints the heads of the different departments. But all those departments, the people that work in them, they're still liberal as fuck. Big government folks. So Scott, now in Wisconsin, the attorney general is elected, but Brad Schimmel gets elected as attorney general. The majority of the DOJ is probably still liberal-leaning. DOJ might be in Wisconsin. Because a lot of people in DOJ, a lot of them come up through law enforcement. You know, people where cops, you can retire for 20 years, and people want to keep going to career. They might move up. They might move up to, you know, another agency. They move to the Department of Justice. So maybe less liberal, still big government, because police are certainly tend to be big government folks. And that's changing. I mean, the conservatives, Republicans are definitely pursuing the voting block of law enforcement the last, what's it been? Two, three years with the Black Lives Matter on one side and the Back the Badge on the other. I think the conservatives saw, and I've always been in the third camp, somewhere in between. I reject Black Lives Matter on every front. I support the fundamental role of law enforcement, though I think they need to make some systemic and cultural changes to restore accountability. But my point being, getting off on a tangent here, which I do a lot, when conservatives take over, when conservatives get elected, it's still very, very difficult to get their things done because at an administrative level, legislatively, look, in Wisconsin, legislatively, we got a lot of shit done in 2010. We had a Republican governor, Scott Walker. We had a Republican Senate, Republican Assembly. But at the agency level, if you appoint, let's just stick to the federal level for now because it's an easier, the EPA. When Trump was elected, he gets to pick his head for the EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, which is a radically liberal government agency. So even when you put a conservative, freedom-minded, smaller government head of the EPA, there's things that they can do, but they get resistance at every level below them because the people that work for them, the people that make up that, the people that write the – I mean, they would certainly be dragging their feet. You know, you want to rewrite some regulations, and Trump's EPA did. They got rid of a ton of regulations. But believe me, that process was hindered and inhibited at every level by the people that work in – and these people have civil service protections. They can't just be fired. You know, Scott Walker – or not Scott Walker. Donald Trump is elected president. He picks his head of the EPA. That person doesn't get to come in and clean house and hire all new people at the EPA. I don't know. There might be even some high-level people that are appointees. Like maybe they're, you know, two or three top directors at the EPA. I don't know that don't know this level of detail for sure, but it's possible that, you know, at a high level, they can replace some of those people, but your workforce at the EPA, your day, you know, your average, you know, EPA coordinator, employee, technician, I don't know what the job titles are over at the EPA, but your policy, right, you know, regulatory reviewer, those are still radical liberals. And so when a conservative takes over, just getting the agencies to pivot and to start following your conservative protocol, your conservative policy decisions, it's very, very difficult. But when a liberal takes over, super easy because everything they want to do, the people in, you know, their underlings are happy to do. And so where was I going? I started this with the liberals are just masters of government. They mastered the mechanisms of government. They're masters of government at every level. So now I forgot where I was going with that when I went into this whole tangent. I was talking about something. Oh, that's great radio. So I can't even remember where I was going with this. Anyway, I guess I'm going to have to – that's what happens when you get – I get one tangent deep and I'm good. I get two tangents deep and then I lose my train of thought of where I was in that first tangent. It's going to come to me in a second here. But, you know, as I was talking about it's just – I keep thinking it's going to pop in my head. But anyway, so I was talking about the snow. I was talking about the weather. Talking about – it's gone. How do you like that? Maybe I'm getting Alzheimer's. I shouldn't joke about that, but I tend to be a bit of a hypochondriac. I always think that I kid. So this past week, a couple little small talk things here. I was going to talk, you know, we've got, I was talking about the weather, talking about news. That's what it was. Okay. It's all back to me now. I was talking about the news. I like watching the news. I was talking about Coronanoia last year and how everything is orchestrated by the liberals. Everything's orchestrated by the liberals. Nothing happens by accident. When liberals take control of government, they can get what they want to get done so easily and so quickly because everybody that's working in their departments are ready, willing, and able and have the same personal proclivities. So it's just once – so liberals, again, they're masters of government. They know how to coordinate. And the media is the liberal establishment. That is the liberal the media makes and breaks liberals. And so what the media wants, the media gets, generally speaking. When the media wants to turn on a liberal, they can. The media couldn't turn on Trump, but they, because he didn't, they, you know, he's above that. But so my point being that, you know, nothing happens by accident. That orchestrated nature of the coronavirus frenzy that started last year at this time was very orchestrated. So it was on the news. It was orchestrated with the news. It was orchestrated through, you know, government policy making and stuff. And it just, so that's what I really couldn't, I couldn't stomach watching local news anymore. Ralph from Pleasant Prairie is in tonight. Ralph, good to have you in. Also, I said hi to Lon on the chat, but Lon from Wausau is tuned in as well. And anybody else that's listening, if you're tuned in, feel free to drop a hello on the chat and I can say hi, or on the Well-Armed Radio Facebook page. But I'm back to news and watching. I just can't stand to watch network news because even the local network news is just saturation propaganda. And so I do watch Newsmax on my smart TV. I watch One America News. I actually like One America News better than Newsmax. It's just more entertaining, but that's what I like to watch. And so it's, yeah, that's where, you know, I was going with that topic is just the news is so much propaganda. It's so coordinated that I can't even stand to watch that anymore. So I end up watching, like I said, One America News, Newsmax online, and that's where I watch for news, because I used to just love watching the news, and now all I do is watch the weather, local weather, and then that's really it, and then I turn it off, because again, and that's where I started this whole thing. Now we're all back. I started talking about it snowing outside and how if the snow was happening in November, the local television stations would be all doing their standard reporting from the Milwaukee Department of Public Works, talking about how many plow trucks they're going to have out. And now this time of year, late February, this snow that we're getting right now is just yeah, whatever. And like I said, I don't even know how much we're supposed to get, but if it was, if this was November, it would have been hyped on the news stations for a week. And again, even though I don't watch that much local news anymore, cause I can't stand it. So that's where that whole thing started with talking about the weather. Speaking of the weather, snowmobiling, I went snowmobiling on Friday. Man, that is so much fun. Friend took me, oops, let me quiet my, Zach is in. Zach from New Richmond. Good to have you with us again tonight, Zach. Appreciate you chiming in there. Here in Wisconsin, this happens every time someone takes me snowmobiling. I had a friend who took me snowmobiling. He's got some really nice sleds. Let me ride his brand new, what is it, the 60th anniversary edition Polaris 800R or something like that. Super nice sled. But every time someone takes me, I'm like, God, this is so much fun. You get to see places that you could never see. You would never get to go to. I mean, you drive country roads. You can drive country roads all day long in Wisconsin. But these snowmobile trails go through farmers' fields, places that you wouldn't be allowed to go through any other time of year. I mean, there'd be crops planted. You can't hike them. They're not trails where you can go hiking. Some of them do, like, you know, you get to like where the state forests are and some of the state natural areas. And then the snowmobile trails sometimes go through there. And those are places that you could potentially hike, you know, year round. But we were down by the town of Raymond. So Kenosha and Racine, and just to get to fly across these cornfields and farmers' fields, and you get to like their back, this is kind of a cliche, their back 40, where their properties, you know, meet others, and there's a little creek that goes through and a little grove of trees. It's just unbelievably beautiful. And again, it's stuff you'd never see from the roads because, you can't go to these places. It's not like during the summer you could take a motocross bike or a mountain bike or anything. These trails are just specifically in the winter with the permission of landowners. And then only when you get enough snow. And there's years, like I think last year my friend said he only went snowmobiling twice because the trails, and he's getting down by Town of Raymond, that's south of Milwaukee. So I would have a snowmobile in a heartbeat if we had the kind of snow we've had this year every year, because that is so much fun. I mean, it's so scenic. The power, I mean, it's incredible how fast those things can pick up and go, and you're on snow. It's just the scenery, the power, you can stop at all these, backwoods, out in the middle of nowhere corner bars that have 50 sleds parked outside of them and go in and have a drink. It's super fun. So that's what I did Friday. Also, again, things that nobody in the gun world cares about, but had a total bummer this past week. It was this week or the week before. I think it was this week. Mercury comes out with, have you guys seen this? You guys who fish, you're into your outboards. Mercury Marine comes out with a new outboard motor, 600 horsepower V12 on an outboard. An outboard motor for a boat. They're basically outboards made for yachts and large center consoles and really large, 600. Look, my yacht, I've got triple Mercury 450 R's, which last year when I ordered my yacht was the top of the line motor you could get from Mercury. There's other, Seven Marine makes some high horsepower outboards, but Seven Marine, like, they're really not well built engines in terms of, they're loud. It's basically, I think they took a car engine and slapped it in the back of a boat, turned it into an outboard. But these engines, Mercury engines are just, they're the top of the line. They're the most technologically advanced for outboards. So I had the triple 450 R's on my boat. And then now I'm super bummed because now they've got a 600 horsepower outboard. And I'm like, what the hell? You couldn't even give me a year or two of having the big dogs on the back of my boat. And now they've got a better motor out. And I was thinking, do I need to repower? And of course I say that jokingly, I wouldn't repower my boat after a year, but I'm not super tempted, because I'll tell you what they're going to do with these. The cool thing, these 600 horsepower outboards, multiple cool things, but so V12 engine, the outboard itself, no longer, the engine no longer rotates. Like, if you anybody who's got an outboard on their boat, that when you turn the motor, you turn the whole motor. Well, these new outboards, to turn, it only rotates the lower unit. So the top, the part of the engine where the engine block is, the part of the engine where it's covered by the cowl, that stays stationary, and only the lower unit rotates, which is super cool. They're two speeds. They've got an automatic transmission. So when they shift, they've got two gears, low end and then the mid range or whatever. Just an incredible, and they're only $77,000 a piece. Like, my engines were like $68,000 a piece. These are only, what is that, $9,000 more? I mean, I'd have thought that there's something they'd be charging like over $100,000 for one of some of these outboards. But so it's the Mercury V12, 600 horsepower, Mercury Verado V12, 600 horsepower. Now, here's what I'm about to tell you, make my prediction. They're going to slap a supercharger on this thing, because that's what the R engines are, is supercharged. And so I've got the 450 R's, which I'm just guessing is probably the 400. Although I'm not sure if the 400 is a V8. But anyway, I'm just willing to bet that they're going to take this 600 horsepower V12 Verado, work the bugs out on it, and then in 2 years or 18 months, they'll slap a supercharger on it, and that's probably going to give it another, 150 horsepower maybe. Maybe that's a little bit rich. Maybe it'll only give me 100 extra. And they call it like the 750R, the 700R. Same engine block, same 12-cylinder setup, but just so that's the one that I'm going to start drooling over. So I'm not letting myself get too upset that the 600 Verado is out. But once they slap the supercharger on that thing, then I'm going to start watering at the mouth for for either getting a new yacht or repowering the one I got. So anyway, get into the meat of the show. Enough of this small talk. I wanted to start the show with a tribute to Rush Limbaugh. Rush Limbaugh passed away. I should start the show, and I've already been small talking for 28 minutes here, 25 minutes. But I wanted to start the meat of the show, the hardcore segments here, not the small talk, not the off-topic stuff, with a tribute to Rush Limbaugh. So, and I didn't want to say the same things other people have said. I wrote this down this week, and I thought I'd share it with you guys, and we kind of reminisce together. And anybody who's listening, I'd love to hear, your what's your lingering memory? There could be many. What's your, everybody remembers their first. What was your first memory? When did you come to know Rush Limbaugh? When did you listen to him first? When did you, I'm just kind of curious because everybody's probably going to have a different, some people might have been. I mean, I hear people on Rush Limbaugh's show say, oh, I was a Rush baby. I was 5 years old and 6 years old. I'd come home from school. My mom was listening to Rush Limbaugh, and she'd make me listen. And I grew up listening to Rush. I was a little bit older than that. I mean, I call myself a Reagan kid. I was born in 74. And I think Rush hit the airwaves 88 or 89 and then syndicated after that. So I think he hit the airwaves when I was like a freshman in high school slash – yeah, fresh. That's just the thing to be a freshman in high school. 88. No, I think that would have been 87. I think I started high school in 87, 88. My sophomore year was, no, take it back. Freshman year was 88, 89. Sophomore year was 89, 90. Yeah. Junior year was 90, 91. Senior year was 91, 92. That's it. I didn't catch much of Rush except maybe seeing him on the news or something. As he swept the country, as his show went to syndicate, syndicate across country. So I'll just start in with these things I wrote down. I wrote this down. I'm going to read what I wrote down earlier in the week, as I think it was Wednesday when Rush passed away. Early 1999. Sorry, messed it up again. In early 1993, I had just dropped out of DePaul University because I couldn't afford it. Moved home and started to work. A couple jobs to save money so I could enroll at UW-Whitewater where I could afford to pay my own way through college. So, I was feeling down because nobody ever thinks you're going to be a college dropout. And that's essentially what I was. I mean, it was a strategic dropout. I didn't drop out because of grades. I didn't drop out to not go back in. I dropped out because of money. But a lot of people, once they drop out, they never get back in. So I was acutely aware of that when I dropped out of DePaul. But I was home. I was working a lot, working all day long, a couple jobs, two, three jobs sometimes, save money. And then, so I get home one night, it's late, I don't know what time it was. It was 10:30. I don't remember what station, but I was in the living room, one night watching the one little TV that we had at my parents' house down in Delvin, Wisconsin, little tiny TV, only one we had in the house. And we didn't have cable. So it had to be on one of the three local network channels we got. I don't remember which one it was on, but the Rush Limbaugh TV show came on. Rush Limbaugh had a TV show. I think it was from like 92 to 96 for about 4 years. So he had the TV show, after he hit it big, then he starts with his TV show. So maybe that was 4 years or so after he got his start. Turn it into a TV show. So the Rush Limbaugh TV show came on, and it was the first time I'd ever heard or seen. Now, check that. I may have heard or seen Rush Limbaugh before, but I'd never listened to his show. I'd never listened to a show. If I heard or see anything about him, it was on the news. And I remember thinking that. He had a book. I think it was, I forget if the book was See, I Told You So or The Way Things Ought to Be. I forget which one he wrote first, but I thought that kind of sounded like an arrogant topic or arrogant thing. So I grew up conservative. I never remember having any interest in supporting Democrats. I remember in elementary school supporting Ronald Reagan. It's just always been the way that I leaned. And some of that came from hearing from my dad when I was in middle school, his advice politically, which was just very limited. The only thing my ever dad told me in politics, said, Dad, are you Republican or Democrat? He said, Nick, if you think you can spend your money on yourself for the best of yourself by yourself, then vote. I screwed that up. If you think you can spend your money on what you need better than the government, vote Republican. If you think the government can spend your money on what you need for you better than you could, vote Democrat. And that's pretty much been a great piece of advice. So I've always leaned Republican, gotten to be a stronger conservative as I gotten older. So anyway, the Rush Limbaugh show came on. It was the first time I'd ever heard or seen Rush Limbaugh in full form, not just a clip on a TV show or heard the name. I wasn't all that big into politics at the time. Again, I was a Reagan kid and had always felt drawn to Republicans and supported Republican candidates. But I remember a segment on that show, the first show I ever saw from Rush Limbaugh. It showed a press conference at a construction site. Don't remember where it was, but there were a dozen, you know, suits gathered in behind the podium where some elected official took to the microphone. Now, this elected official had a hard hat on, and he was the only one in the group that had a hard hat. Now, I don't recall for certain, but I believe the head suit that was doing this presser was a mayor or something. So Rush shows a video clip of the news conference and then paused the video and said, "What's wrong with this picture?" And he pointed out that the only person wearing a hard hat was the mayor. Again, I think it was a mayor. A dozen other suits were standing behind the mayor for this press conference, but the mayor was the only one wearing a hard hat. And I believe Rush used the term then that was symbolism over substance. And I'm not 100% sure on that, because I know he used it later in his career. I remember Rush Limbaugh using that term, symbolism over substance. But maybe I'm conflating the two, but Rush pointed out, you know, why is the mayor the only one wearing a hard hat? I mean, if this is a place where safety equipment is required, if it's a safety requirement, why do none of the other suits at that press conference have hard hats on? And again, so I don't want to misquote him, but I was watching and I was like, that's right. I mean, it was a moment that I've never forgotten. I realized that what you see on TV is manipulated. What comes from politicians and the media is manipulated. It's not honest. It's very orchestrated. It's devious, and it insults our intelligence. And I didn't hear this quote till many years later, but you've heard me use it probably. The original quote was from Mark Twain: "If you don't read the newspaper, you're uninformed. If you do read the newspaper, you're misinformed." And I always say, if you don't watch the news, you're uninformed. If you do watch the news, you're misinformed. But it was a moment for me, and it was a moment that to recognize that media needed to be viewed very skeptically, very cynically. And it was a moment to realize that politicians are phony, and recognize that media needed to be viewed with a mistrust, a healthy mistrust. And that media is all about appearances. Politicians are all about appearances. And like Rush Limbaugh said, I think it was at that time, symbolism over substance. Now, I didn't listen to Rush my whole adult life. I didn't need to. You know, I knew he agreed with me, and I knew that he was right in his political positions. I knew that I was right. I mean, there were the times that I did have the opportunity to listen to Rush. You know, I didn't tune in to hear him tell me what to think about something. I tuned in to hear him express my thoughts to millions of people. Now, there were times when Rush had information and some angles that I had not thought of, but there was a level of comfort in hearing, you know, common sense, in hearing someone else who gets it, and in hearing someone that was honestly, I think, virtually always right, someone who I virtually always agreed with. And that doesn't happen very often. I mean, listening to talk show hosts on WISN, I mean, I agree with them often. I agree with them most of the time. But Belling, I mean, I've been in complete disagreement with Belling on a few issues. Dan O'Donnell, don't get me started. I mean, I think Dan O'Donnell's a great researcher. But I've had, many times where I was just, you know, swearing at the radio for things. Like when Dan O'Donnell tried to tell us that the Bucks getting $250 million of government money to build their stadium, that was the free market at work. I about puked. But, Jay Weber, same thing, disagree with him on many things. Vicky, it's hard to think of a time when I disagree with Vicky. I mean, there's probably been a time or two, but it was just an incredible comfort to know that there was a voice for freedom on that level, you know, Rush Limbaugh's level nationally, a voice for tens of millions. And it wasn't tens of millions of people tuning in to his show to be told how to think. It was tens of millions of people tuning in to hear their thoughts expressed, you know, sometimes more eloquently than they could themselves. But Rush could verbalize your feelings and your beliefs and your principles and your instincts better than you could in some cases. And many people have this instinctual sense of right and wrong. And, you know, their upbringing instilled that, and human nature instills it. So they feel it. They know what's right and they know what's wrong, but they can't always describe it. They can't always articulate it, especially in the face of a liberal. I mean, I've had friends who, you know, they believe in conservative principles, but then something comes up and they just can't, you know, they can't justify they can't make sense of the Republican position, platform position, compared to, you know, the criticisms they feel they want to support the Republican platform, the conservative platform issue, but they don't. So Rush could explain those things, and so whether it's because a lot of conservatives fall off the, you know, minimum wage, conservatives that might say, well, I'm conservative, but I support Social Security. You know, actually, if you're a true conservative and you want, because they, oh, we need a safety net. If you understood deeper, you would realize that Social Security is generational theft that is destroyed prosperity in this country. But so again, so there, but for the most part, people feel they have good instincts, conservatives have good instincts in certain issues, but Rush could describe what people felt and they may not have been able to express. But here's another something, my respect for Rush Limbaugh reached epic proportions during the 2016 presidential campaign, because while Mark Belling and Vicky McKenna, who's again a close personal friend, but Jay Weber and Dan O'Donnell were pissing me off with their relentless Trump bashing. I was a Cruz supporter at the time. I was a Cruz supporter in the primary in 2016, but I loved what Trump brought to the race. You know, Rush Limbaugh respected his audience so damn much that he never picked a side, and he never endorsed Cruz or Trump. He respected his listeners enough to not attempt to tell them how to think. He never endorsed either Trump or Cruz, or, you know, certainly not Kasich. But instead of trying to pick a side and guide his listeners one way or the other, he explained Trump. He explained angles, our own biases and preferences, or just our lack of inside knowledge prevented us from seeing. But when every other talk show host in the world, I mean, including Hannity was in the bag for Trump, which is fine. I mean, he was obviously right, but that was still, at the time, it pissed me off because Hannity was rude to Ted Cruz. I think he had Ted Cruz on a couple times, and Hannity was just flat out rude to him. And everybody else in the world was trying to tell people what to do, who to support, and Rush didn't. And that's just so incredibly principled of Rush Limbaugh. It tells you the kind of character he had and how he truly understood his value to his listeners, he understood why people listen. They didn't want him telling them what to think. They liked how he could describe how people felt in ways that they couldn't. So, I mean, man, it brought me to tears on Wednesday. Here's a guy that, again, I it's not like I was a daily listener. There's people who listen. They were in I know traveling salesmen who were in their car every day and they listened to Rush every single day. And there was times I listened. There was always like big events. I think after 9/11, I tuned in pretty religiously for a while. But then I went and spent years. I think I went probably 10 years without really listening to him much at all. Maybe I'd catch him on a Friday when I left work early, but I didn't like have him on the radio in my office. A coworker that I knew did down the way in the offices, but I wasn't like a regular daily listener. I didn't need to listen daily, but I was sure I'd heard enough to know that Rush was he was almost always right. I mean, probably always right. And I agree with them on just about everything. I didn't need to listen every day. What an incredible loss. I mean, he's just, when you are so committed and driven for freedom like I am, and to have a voice like Rush's be gone, it's just, I don't know, it's crushing. But, you know, liberals are celebrating, and I don't care, but I'll tell you this. Liberals think if it wasn't for Rush Limbaugh, people wouldn't hold, you know, conservative beliefs. I mean, they think that Rush told people what to think. And that's the liberal miscalculation. People didn't need Rush to make them conservative. They maybe in some cases needed Rush to articulate their feelings, but people still believe in freedom and people still know freedom when they see it. And they know what freedom is not. And if liberals think conservative thought is gone because Rush Limbaugh is gone, I mean, they're in for a rude awakening. excuse me, rough week, total bummer. But I'll tell you, I had a feeling when Rush left, signed off for the Christmas vacation, because he always takes Christmas off. his last show before Christmas vacation was a very sentimental, what's the other word I'm looking for? A very retrospective, a very, very gracious show. And so I thought there, he might not make it back after the first of the year. You know, he'd said at the time, you know, every day he wakes up, he's glad he woke up. And turns out he did make it back after the holiday, after the Christmas break, after the New Year's break. But then on February 2nd, I think when his last show was, and I have been listening for a while. I think since I started my own company and I've been home working out of a home office, I listen quite a bit to Rush Limbaugh. I usually have talk radio on. There's been about a year, two year period where I did listen to talk radio because I just couldn't. Right after the Nicholson primary, I got so sick of local talk radio and they're trying to push people to the establishment Republicans. So I did go a couple years without listening, but then, you know, I've been listening again for, oh gosh, I think since, I think I started listening again after early fall, maybe before the election, started listening to talk radio again. But anyway, so February 2nd, when Rush signed off, I think he said he was going to be back the next day, and then he wasn't. And then there was a couple other days where he missed. They said, yeah, Rush just needed another day of rest. He'll be back tomorrow. And then he wasn't. And I started thinking, yeah, I don't think Rush is going to make it back. That might have been his last show. And yeah, it turns out it was. Again, passed away this past Wednesday. So rest in peace, Rush Limbaugh. You know, God bless you. The country is, I mean, when they use the term larger than life, that truly was Rush Limbaugh. I mean, he was larger than life. And just what an incredible career he had, what an incredible impact he had. I mean, he changed media. There's no other person that I think that's been as impactful. No president, no candidate he's been the most impactful person on politics in America for 30 years. And he's gone. So more than 30 years, probably. So anyway, moving on, Kyle Rittenhouse case. Jessica McBride wrote an article. She's the reporter that had an affair with former Milwaukee police chief Ed Flynn. But she now writes for the Wisconsin Right Now website. And they had a story. I didn't quote the whole story here, but the takeaway from this story is that they interviewed some other witnesses from the Kyle Rittenhouse case, witnesses that saw Kyle Rittenhouse shoot the first guy, witnesses that I think are going to go a long way to exonerate Kyle Rittenhouse. I mean, I've said this before, I'll say it again. I don't think you'll find a jury in Kenosha to convict Kyle Rittenhouse of anything. But the good thing that I've heard is from this story that Jessica McBride did, is the judge in this case, in Kyle Rittenhouse's case, appears to be very law and order, which is good, because we don't need a biased judge for the Kyle Rittenhouse case or a judge who favors the Second Amendment. The law is very clear, and I think the law is on Kyle's side. I think it's on our side. And if this case goes by the book, not by the activist, politically driven, outcome-seeking track, I think Kyle will be acquitted. And so both the prosecution in this case, they've been trying to get Kyle Rittenhouse's bail revoked and altered and, you know, all kinds of things. And the judge slapped them down and was pretty scolding of the prosecutors in this case for some of the things that they've asked the judge to do. So it was a conclusion of Jessica McBride, and there was one other reporter, but the judge is very by the book, and he's going to be very fair. And I share that after hearing her describe what happened. And so that's pleasing to me because, you know, the judges make a huge difference in cases like these, what the jury gets to hear, what they don't get to hear, what's allowed in court, what's not allowed in court. So it's really good to hear that the judge is a law and order guy, because I think that bodes well for Kyle getting a fair trial. I'm still, the only thing I'm concerned about is the jury pool packing. Jury selection takes place amongst the jury pool. You know, you got jurors that come into the courthouse for jury duty. they're paraded into the courtroom, and I think it's called Voir Dire. I might be wrong here, but I think it's called Voir Dire, which means see clearly, which is where the attorneys can ask questions of the prospective jurors, and then they get to strike, I think, each of the pool of however many jurors come into the courtroom, they each get to strike a number, and then what's left is the jury. So that part, the attorneys have their input on. But what I'm worried about is Kenosha County packing the jury pool. Someone, you know, the people that send out those jury duty notices, not sending them out randomly and packing the jury pool with activist liberals who are committed to commit Kyle Rittenhouse. That's what I worry about. So that in other words, what I'm worried about is that every person that ends up in that jury pool that the attorneys get to select from and strike from, that it's going to be a fait accompli because everybody there is already predisposed to convict Kyle Rittenhouse because they didn't take, I think if you take an honest random sampling of the citizens of Kenosha, do your normal jury pool selection, there's no way you don't have a juror that refuses to acquit Kyle. I can't see a random sampling of 12 people, 12 jurors from Kenosha County. I can't see that resulting in not one person who steadfastly believes that that's self-defense. Especially after seeing the evidence that we've seen, and there's going to be more evidence that we haven't seen, but so as long as that jury pool isn't 100% stacked with committed lefties. And the thing is, the juries are generally not anonymous. So they would be able to research this. So I'm hope. But look, if you can steal a presidential election, how hard would it be for one county to pack a jury pool? But juries aren't anonymous, so they'd be able to research the jurors. And I think that it's a transparent enough process that maybe the ability for them to pack the jury pool would be difficult, but that's really the only thing I'm worried about. Real quick one here. I watch just enough news to get pissed off. Hero is way overused. I was going to pull the audio and I didn't have time, but there was a news report this past week. Here's the story. Up in West Bend, there's a plow driver driving, plowing snow, and he finds a five-year-old in his pajamas walking down the street while he's plowing, single-digit temperatures. And the plow driver stops, and the plow driver picks up this five-year-old kid and puts him in the cab of his plow truck and gets him all warmed up. Again, he's out there on the street in pajamas. And the news media does a story about it, which, again, a very interesting story. It's a worthy news item. But the news media or the news reported that she hails the plow truck driver as a hero. And it kind of makes me chuckle. Now, first, why take issue with this? I mean, so, okay, the guy's a hero. Why not just, okay, because here's my thing. If everyone's a hero, then no one is. And I think if we lower the bar for heroes, then real heroes won't get the recognition they deserve. And everyone who does anything will think that they deserve the hero label and the participation trophies and global adoration of the term hero. Since COVID, you drive down the street and you see these, there's a nursing home not far from where I live here in New Berlin. It says superheroes work here. And I'm like, oh, wasn't just heroes wasn't good enough for them. It's got to be their superheroes. And it's like, I just think the term hero is so overused that it's not a good thing. It drives that participation trophy mentality that anybody who does anything thinks that they are entitled to, some great reward and recognition. I mean, again, if everybody's a hero, no one's a hero. You're driving a plow in the early morning / late night hours. You see a five-year-old in pajamas. 99 out of 100 people are going to stop and help the little kid out. You're not running into a burning building to save a puppy. That's heroic. You aren't risking your life. You aren't sacrificing money or time or your job or an appointment. You're not like running late for work and you're going to... You're a city plow driver. You pick up a five-year-old, you put him in your warm truck and you call police. I mean, Good Samaritan, sure. Hero, come on. This is just... Kyle Rittenhouse is a hero. I think the term fits. He risked his life to protect someone else's business. He went into a dangerous situation. Some criticize him for that. I admire him for it. But he did something that most people would not do. Most people didn't do. I mean, believe me, I felt like I saw the clips on social media of the mattress store owner in Kenosha getting his head bashed in, trying to protect his business. I saw the people the next morning crying because their business was burned to the ground in Kenosha. That made me angry. It made me want to do something to help. But was I going to go down to Kenosha and protect the business? I have too much to lose. I end up in a situation with Kyle Rittenhouse. I get sued. So I admire Kyle. He had the balls to do it. Now, again, maybe he's just young, dumb, and full of you-know-what, but he did something that most people wouldn't do. Even people that wanted to do something, even people that would want to help like me, he did something that we didn't do. Because he felt compelled to help and he was driven to do the right thing. He took a big risk. That's heroic. Combat veterans who face bullets whizzing over their head in combat, I mean, that's heroic. Concealed carry holders who take down a mass shooting suspect instead of running away. They hear shooting and they in a mall and they run towards it instead of running away and saving themselves. That's heroic. I mean, you're putting something at risk. Cops who put themselves in danger to stop a threat. Not the cops who set up a perimeter at the Sikh temple and wait 2 hours to go in while people bled to death from non-life-threatening wounds that quick medical attention could have saved. But I mean cops that truly put themselves into danger. Not that cop down in Parkland, Florida, the coward Broward coward who didn't go into the school when the shooting started. But if everyone thinks they're a hero for doing something that anyone would do, I just think that's a bad path to walk down, because then comes entitlement and then comes the participation trophies and the expectations of a grand reward for just doing basic things. And that was something I saw this past week. I thought I'd bring it up here in the show. Britt Hume on Fox News advises the GOP needs to move away from Trump without alienating his supporters. And I shake my head at this crap from the media. Britt Hume, I mean, GFY, seriously, man, these arrogant media types who think that anything that they say matters. I mean, these political pundits like Britt Hume on Fox News, they're more irrelevant than MySpace. Just media, these establishment media elite, I can't even talk tonight. Establishment media elitists who want to create their own alternate reality. It's not based upon facts and it's not prescient and it's not accurate. It's just a bunch of bullshit, but they want it to be true. So they think saying it will get people thinking it. So Britt Hume thinks if he goes on his national broadcast for Fox News and says that the GOP needs to move away from Trump without alienating his supporters. Says who? You, Britt Hume? I mean, you were like one of these never Trumper guys in the first place. So you think you're some, this reminds me of like Reince Priebus, who thought that, he likes the matchup of Leah Vukmir and versus Tammy Baldwin, which we all know how that went. Leah Vukmir got her clock cleaned by Tammy Baldwin. But Reince Priebus thought it was a great matchup. These guys don't know shit. These establishment politicals. Did you hear now Reince Priebus is talking about running for governor? I mean, hell no, of Wisconsin. That guy's just as establishment can be. And he would, that would just be disgusting for Reince Priebus if he became governor. And obviously better than Tony Evers. But I mean, honestly, in the primary, I sure hope we have better choices than Reince Priebus and Becky Clefish. I'd love to see if Ron Johnson wants to run for governor, if Sheriff Clark wants to run for governor. Kevin Nicholson, I don't think he wants to run for governor, and I just don't think that he thinks that he's positioned for that. I think Kevin Nicholson wants to run for U.S. Senate again. I have a hunch of why I think that is. It's just a total hunch, and I have no, so I'm not going to share it. But I think everybody's waiting to see what Ron Johnson does. If Ron Johnson wants to run for governor, then there's going to be people running for his Senate seat. If Ron Johnson runs for Senate again, I think there's people that won't be running for the Senate seat. But I just, I get sick of these establishment Republican elitists who try to tell everybody else what to think, how to think, what we need to do, what strategy we need. That's all bullshit. It's all not even wishful thinking, but wishful mind control on behalf of these sellout Republican. I think Brit Hume was one of the Never Trumpers. Pretty sure he was. But anyway, speaking of the GOP moving away from Trump supporters, we conservatives are more often than not, it seems, disappointed in the lack of conservative backbone of our elected officials. So I'm going to point something out that I think has gotten zero attention from conservatives. When we talk about these establishment Republicans, is anyone else concerned about Brian Stile? First Congressional District replaced Paul Ryan. So Brian Stile voted against impeachment, which is good. He released a statement about impeachment, which I thought was pretty well targeted, pretty well principled. But we all know that Brian Stile is a Paul Ryan understudy. And we should all know by now that the swamp runs much deeper than conservative principles. Paul Ryan was Speaker of the House. He dissed Donald Trump at every turn. He even told his caucus to feel free to distance themselves from Trump after the 2016 Access Hollywood video, that October surprise. You might recall Paul Ryan disinvited Trump from a rally in Elkhorn at the fairgrounds. And then Trump wins anyway. And when Republicans had the Senate, the House, and presidency early in Trump's term, Paul Ryan dragged his feet and I think hindered some of Trump's efforts. And recently, Paul Ryan made comments about how he denounced Republican efforts to challenge electoral votes. I mean, it was just, I'll read some of these to you, some of this crap that Paul Ryan said. Efforts to reject the votes of the Electoral College and sow doubt about Joe Biden's victory strike at the foundation of our Republican. I think he meant to say Republic, but this is what it says here in this CBS story. Efforts to reject the votes of the Electoral College and sow doubt about Joe Biden's victory strike at the foundation of our republic. Again, it says Republican here. Ryan, a former GOP congressman from Wisconsin who retired in 2018, said a statement. He called the expected action from House and Senate Republicans a, quote, federal intervention to overturn the results of state-certified elections and disenfranchise millions of Americans. Quote, the fact that this effort will fail does not mean it will not do significant damage to American democracy, Paul Ryan added. And there's some other comments that Paul Ryan makes, but those are comments Paul Ryan made recently. I think Paul Ryan, I call him Paul Rhino, but these people that thought that Paul Ryan was like the second coming of conservative God. Some of it was just because he was from Wisconsin and people in the first congressional district knew him. But not going to lie, I think you'd have to be a fool to think Brian Stile doesn't face influence from Paul Ryan and the Ryan faithful. Because you got to remember how much people kissed Paul Ryan's ass. Remember how Paul Ryan was the greatest conservative ever, according to people in the party, talk radio, Southeast Wisconsin. And yeah, we clearly know Paul Ryan was a swamp creature now. I think that's why Paul Ryan didn't run for re-election, why he retired in 2018, because he didn't like being part of the great things Trump was doing. I think Paul Ryan might be one of the biggest Republican frauds ever. I truly believe that. People kept saying, oh, he studied under Jack Kemp and he was a conservative policy wonk and a fiscal. Maybe he was a fiscal hawk, but that was it. Because for him to retire, and maybe he was retiring because they were going to lose the majority, the Republicans were supposedly going to lose the majority, but I just think Paul Ryan didn't like being part of the Trump win. I think I remember people saying his wife's a big old lib. But yeah, I don't have a lot of respect for Paul Ryan at all. But back to Brian Stile. I mean, Brian Stile was a Paul Ryan understudy, and these political connections run super deep. If you ask me, I think Paul Ryan is prime for being a sellout. And some might say that's unfair. You know, he's been solid so far, it appears. And that's true. I mean, so far, I couldn't really point to anything Brian Stile has done. But keep your eye on him, is all I'm saying. He's a Paul Ryan protege, and you got to be crazy not to be on guard for a sellout, given what we've seen from Paul Ryan. So just threw that out there. Next thing I was going to talk about on the show today is one of the reasons I'm feeling – As we have to shift our thought processes because the frustration with the stolen election, and if elections are stolen this time, they'll be stolen again, and feckless Republicans who aren't going to do anything about it. It's just like, where do we go from here? How do I, as the president of Wisconsin, Kerry, say to people, we got to contact your legislators? Because, I mean, it seems inconsequential when I believe elections are going to be stolen again. We're not going to be able to win a statewide race. We're not going to be able to have a governor that would ever sign a pro-gun bill. We probably won't be able to get super majorities. But if we did get super majorities in the Senate and the Assembly with guys like Robin Voss as the Senate Assembly leader, they're not going to push through gun bills. So this level of frustration that, at least here in Wisconsin, we're kind of fucked. I don't think we could have a Republican president again until we get election reform. We would need it in Wisconsin, which we're not going to get it. We would need it in the swing states like Pennsylvania, which we might. I've heard the Pennsylvania legislature is going after this stuff. Michigan, Georgia, Arizona. I've heard the Arizona Senate is trying to call for arrests of election officials. That gives me hope, because it would just take a couple of these people who participated in these election rigging to go to jail, a couple of these underlings to go to jail, and it would scare the shit out of all of them, and they'd stop doing it. Now, I'm not holding my breath. I don't think anybody's going to jail, but I like that I'm hearing from, like, an example like the Arizona Senate, that they were calling for election officials to be arrested. Just gives you a glimmer of hope, and hope is a dangerous thing right now, because, again, we're over the cliff. We're over the cliff. We're not in a slippery slope towards socialism. We are over the cliff, dangling above the precipice of totalitarianism, and we really need a lifeboat. We need a helicopter rescue at this point. But here's something that, again, gives me hope, is that we should learn from the GameStop short squeeze. Are you guys familiar with this? What happened was a bunch of internet investors, just a bunch of keyboard cowboys, collectively, to the tune of hundreds of thousands, and maybe it was millions, but hundreds of thousands of people started buying GameStop stock, which some of the big brokerage houses, some of the big hedge funds had short sold. When you short sell a stock, you're essentially selling a stock that you don't own for a promise to pay its future price. If it goes down, you short sell the stock, and then you get the money from the proceeds of the sale. And if it goes down, you only have to pay back what the stock price is at that future date. But if it goes up, then you got to come up with the money. And so the GameStop stock that was shorted by these hedge funds, when people started buying, and that's public information, what companies have, what short positions are there out there in these publicly traded companies. So when it was Wall Street Bets was the Reddit group, when they started buying GameStop and driving up the price, it was called a short squeeze. They squeeze out these, because once the stock rises a certain amount, then you have to pony up the money when you're short on the stock, because the stock isn't going down. You got to come up with the money to make up the difference. So some of these big brokerage houses lost billions of dollars on the GameStop short squeeze. So this was just average, ordinary people with their power and numbers beating the entrenched special interests at their own game. And here's what I would say to you guys and to all of us conservatives, to the 74 million, I think it was like 80 million people that voted for Trump. We have the power in numbers. We are the majority. Most people share our positions. The Make America Great Again majority could rule this country if we just use the power that we have instead of being typical conservatives and playing nice and going along to get along. You know, the woke left is a facade. It's a big bark, but not the bite that they think they have. They don't have the numbers. I learned this back in the open carry banning days several years back when first Starbucks banned open carry and then later, and they didn't face any repercussions for doing it. People were like, oh, those darn open carriers, you know, ruin it for everybody. And they still went and bought their Starbucks coffee. And I knew that was a mistake. I knew it was a mistake, not because before that, these big retailers, big companies were super scared to offend gun owners. Like, that's what you did not do. You do not offend gun owners because you'll get boycotted. But Starbucks then sent a big diss at gun owners and they got away with it. And then that said to other companies like Target, like Walmart, like Dick's Sporting Goods, hey, you guys can diss guns and you're not going to pay you're not going to pay an economic price for it. It was a huge, and I said at the time, it was a huge, huge error for the gun crowd not to lash out and boycott Starbucks. But then after that, I learned this, then you had the Chipotle situation down in Texas and the open carry Texas things that were going on. And then Target and Walmart and others asked people not to open carry. What happened was they banned open carry. What happened was the left was able to use social media to fake an outrage where there wasn't one, using a few real accounts, but also a lot of fake accounts. A business that had 5 million social media followers, 5 million customers. Well, no, let me rephrase. A business that has 5 million customers and then 500 of them on social media spaz out and the business caves. It's a total facade of an outrage, but it fools these disconnected executives. I talked about this way back when it happened, how this thing happens. Through social media, through Twitter bots, through these activist libs, they make these business executives freak out thinking that they're going to get this big boycott if they don't, example, ban open carry. It was through the use of smoke and mirrors that they fooled these network executives, fooled these corporate executives into banning open carry, but it worked. But we know from the last election, we know numbers are on our side. Again, 80 million Americans. And that's just the voting age. That doesn't include their kids and what. But we know numbers on our side. We need to be targeted and deliberate with our boycotting. Republicans, conservatives need Reddit-style targeted attacks. It's hard to sustain a long-term widespread boycott, but short-term targeted boycotts would be highly effective. You know, these 80 million Trump supporters, you know, 20 million actual customers of, say, you know, Walmart, not going there for 2 weeks, Walmart would see a sales job. You don't have to not go to Walmart for the rest of your life. We just need a way to do targeted, whenever any company starts with this woke bullshit. Example, Star Wars, and they boot off that conservative actress. Conservatives need a way to be able to do targeted, massive, strong boycotts. Because we've got the power in numbers. We could hurt these people economically, and we don't have to sacrifice for the rest of our lives. We don't have to go to, you know, pay double at some other place. We can still, we would just, Walmart as an example, if we just boycotted them for 2 weeks at any particular time after they were to diss, you know, open carry, they would have to give in because they would see the numbers drop. Because that, again, there's 80 million of us MAGA folks. But I think this is the path to victory. And I thought about some kind of like conservative boycott strategy. I'm not sure what the best platform is, but you know, that's what we have. I mean, the electoral process has let us down. Establishment Republicans have let us down. I mean, voting could work, but it's very cumbersome. It's so hard to herd cats. It's so hard to get info out to the places that matter, like assembly races. And, you know, the whole state doesn't care, for example, the whole state of Wisconsin doesn't care about the 13th Senate district, which is a big disappointment that that recent primary, John Jagler won the primary over Don Pridemore. But the whole state cares about cancel culture. So, like, if we could just get all the conservatives in the state of Wisconsin to be able to leverage these targeted boycotts, we could have so much power. They didn't do it, but like, let's say Quick Trip dissed some, you know, Quick Trip kicked an open carrier out of their store. Boom, a targeted boycott. Again, you don't have to stop going to Quick Trip for the rest of your life, but you stop going for 1 week or 2 weeks, Quick Trip sees their revenue crashing. They would be on TV apologizing, welcoming open carry back in their stores. And again, that's just one example. But that's what we need. If you saw what happened with Reddit and the GameStop short squeeze, we've got 80 million people that are super pissed off and super motivated. They just need an easy way to express themselves, and these targeted boycotts would be it. We just, and again, I say this as someone who, what's the forum? I mean, you can't do it on MeWe. It's not big enough. Could you do it on Parler? Maybe. Could you do it on Reddit? I don't even know how Reddit works. But we need something like that, a place where conservatives can just see, hey, we're all going to target this week. And again, you don't have to not go there for the rest of your life, but just for 2 weeks, don't go to Quick Trip. I mean, I'm not saying I love Quick Trip. That is just an example. It's not. For 2 weeks, don't go to Walmart. For 2 weeks, don't, whenever these things come up, whenever cancel culture, whenever these companies try to be woke, well, let's give them the rude awakening with. So I don't know how that comes about, but we have the numbers. That's just something I said last week. You know, stop wearing a goddamn mask if you don't agree with the mask bullshit. Look, I mean, if you believe these silly cloth masks work, if you think that that keeps you safe, you think that prevents the spread of coronavirus, I mean, you need to educate yourself. But if you, you know, leaving those points aside, I'm not asking the people to, for you people that listen to this podcast, if you realize that masks are a joke, they're purely symbolic. That's why I call them communist face diapers. These things, masks, are a charade that government has imposed on you to cover up for the fact that they never needed to shut anything down in the first place. This mask thing, again, it's, use Rush Limbaugh's term, it's symbolism over substance. The mask is all for show. I mean, seriously, think about this. The virus was way more prolific in the fall, last October, November, than it was in the spring of 2020. If a virus surge justified a shutdown, I contended it never did. I would have never shut the country down. But if a virus surge, if shutdowns were justified to prevent, to slow the spread, to flatten the curve, then a shutdown was way more justified in the fall than it was in the spring, but we didn't shut down in the fall. But it's my observation that to not put up this charade of mask mandates and virus mitigation plans approved by health departments, talking to you, Milwaukee, this is just a cover charade to alter the reality and distract from the mistake that most governors made of shutting stuff down. They were wrong to shut down in the spring. These lockdowns did nothing. They didn't stop the spread. They didn't slow the spread. And maybe for the first 2 weeks when people really like locked themselves in their house, that might have slowed the spread. But that wasn't sustainable. Because even before lockdown orders were listed, cell phone data showed that people were back out doing the things that they've been doing. But in fact, when we were in a place to handle a surge in coronavirus cases, we had auxiliary hospitals at McCormick Place in Chicago and State Fair in Wisconsin. Those places went 100% unused. Not a person went into them in the last spring. Not a person went into the State Fair Auxiliary Hospital. Now in the fall, they did a couple people, like a handful. They were never needed. They could have got by without them. McCormick Place never, they never needed it. All the auxiliary hospitals in New York never needed them. The hospital at the Javits Center, the hospital at Central Park. But here's what we now know. And I and many others, and perhaps even you yourself, said it in the spring. The government didn't just not do the best thing. It did the exact opposite of what it should have done. It made it worse. I mean, New York to start with. Look at New York. Everyone's like, oh, New York is a hotspot. New York, it was the government policies in New York that made it so bad. The nursing home scandal, Governor Cuomo ordering those are the most vulnerable to coronavirus complications. And Governor Cuomo ordered them to take in patients if they had the coronavirus. That was just a massively deadly mistake that the government perpetuated on people. The ventilator insanity. In New York, they were just shoving people on ventilators left and right. And they were dying. Then they realized later, oh, yeah, we shouldn't be so quick to put them on a ventilator. You know, use the prone position, you know, this, that. Use oxygen, but don't put up. Closing schools, big mistake. Kids should have never been taken out of school. And delaying the spread of the coronavirus, I think, only put seniors at risk because seniors can't stay quarantined forever. If you'd have let the young kids get the coronavirus, get their natural herd immunity, that's what I said in the fall when college started and kids start getting, you should have told those kids, you guys go out and party your asses off. You're all going to get coronavirus. You're here away at college. You can sit in your dorm rooms while you recover. By the time you go home for Thanksgiving break, you'll be immune. When you see your grandparents for Thanksgiving, you'll have already had coronavirus. You won't be putting them at risk. Instead of this slow drip drip of, oh, one kid gets coronavirus, we're going to quarantine them in their dorm room, and then no virtual class for 2 weeks. It's just delaying it. And then all of a sudden, by the time Thanksgiving rolls around and kids are going home to see their grandparents, some of them still had coronavirus. Because, we didn't just do the wrong thing. We did the opposite of the right thing. But that's why we have the mask now, because, see, nothing has changed. And if we just said, okay, go back to normal without the masks, everybody would realize that these government policy decisions in the spring were a complete mistake. But by now putting the masks on people, it's justifying like, oh, because of the masks, we don't have to shut down, which is bullshit. But that's what the propaganda value of the mask is. Well, yeah, we can get stuff going again as long as you wear a mask. Again, these masks don't do shit. There is no evidence that these masks slow the spread, stop the spread in a realistic, real-world situation. There's laboratory evidence that they can stop a droplet in some kind of breath analyzation experiment. But in reality, masks don't do shit. They're not big enough to filter out the coronavirus. Nobody wears them right. People breathe and it blows out your breath up, down, and sideways. Instead of a typical person breathing out of their nose, would be breathing straight down. I think I couldn't prove it in a scientific way, but I think it's entirely possible that these masks made it worse. Entirely possible masks made it worse, but it was a thing. It was a comfort blanket to okay, if you do this, you know, we can stay open, but we don't need to lock down again. Just wear a mask. And then when things start to, virus starts to spike, oh, mask harder. Anyway, moving on here. Utah passes constitutional carry. Missouri pushes Second Amendment legislation. Here's what I was going to say tonight. You know, trust me, legislation doesn't protect the Second Amendment. Now, don't misunderstand. We still want legislation. But legislation alone is actually legislation alone, keyword being alone. If all we get is legislation, it's actually the beginning of the end for gun rights, if that's all you have. Because laws don't protect gun rights. And if you don't believe me, Defense of Marriage Act 1996. Defense of Marriage Act 1996, early 90s, late 80s, gay marriage was a big thing. Everybody was like, you know, against it. They wanted to protect the sanctity of marriage, blah, 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 blah. And so it was so politically popular that they passed the Defense of Marriage Act. Now, again, I'm not opining on gay marriage in any way. This is not an opinion on gay marriage. It's just an observation on the strategy. After liberals lost, after the left lost at every level with gay marriage, how did they get to a point where 19 years later, 2015, we had Obergefell versus Hodges, which was a Supreme Court case where they essentially gutted the Defense of Marriage Act as unconstitutional. 19 years is all it took to go from where even the liberal politicians were against gay marriage to everybody being for gay marriage. Not everybody, but so many people. It was just a land swell of support for gay marriage. And how they did it was cultural change. Gay people, gay actors in the media, all the gays, Queer Eye for the Straight Guy, even gay pride parades. Some of those had some pretty raunchy shit, but it normalized people to it. Gay celebrities coming out of the closet. There was a big cultural push. Gay characters in movies, TV shows about gay people, again, Queer Eye for the Straight Guy. That's how they did it. They pushed a cultural change. And that cultural change obliterated the laws that were passed to protect, quote, the sanctity of marriage. To outlaw gay same-sex marriage. So if people are celebrating that, oh, Utah's got concealed carry and constitutional carry now, and Wisconsin, we've got concealed carry, and concealed carry is, I'm telling you, laws do not protect gun rights. Those laws are going to be flipped in a heartbeat if we lose the cultural change. We have to have cultural change along with, look, legislation is great if cultural change comes with it. If cultural change doesn't come with the gun legislation, it's the beginning of the end. Because we must have a robust gun culture or the laws will collapse and the courts will follow right after the laws collapse. Don't look around and see legislation getting passed and say, we're winning. Look around and judge if we're winning the culture war. This is why I came up with 2A Tuesday. This is why we need 2A Tuesday to go viral like the Ice Bucket Challenge for ALS did. This is why 2A Tuesday had that social media component. This 2A Tuesday. This is why I started it with kids in high school and school age kids, middle school. Because that's the generation we want to get to think guns are cool. Take a picture, wear your 2A stuff on Tuesday. Take a picture, post it to your social media, to your Instagram, to your Twitter, to your Facebook. Well, I don't know what kids use, all this stuff, to your TikTok. 2A Tuesday. If 2A Tuesday goes viral amongst the high school crowd, we're dominating the culture war. Dominating the culture war. And it would only take a few cool kids to participate in 2A Tuesday, put it on their social media, and you get all kinds of kids participating to it. Again, there's other ways probably to drive a cultural change, but I have yet to hear someone suggest one. I'm biased because I came up with the idea. I have yet to hear someone suggest one that I think is as effective as 2A Tuesday could be. But we need that cultural change, because if we don't have that cultural change, all these laws are going to collapse in one fell swoop, likely. There'll be a big court ruling against them or something, and boom, gone. So we really need to push this cultural change. Don't be happy when you see Utah passing constitutional carry. Look for the cultural change. Is the culture changing? And I'm telling you right now, I don't think it is. Are the kids in high school right now more pro-gun or less pro-gun? And I think with all the indoctrination of public schools, we'd have to say less pro-gun. That means we're losing. I don't care what laws get passed. I don't care what sanctuary counties or cities come to be. That means we're losing. I got 6 minutes left. I'll hit this next topic I had. I think it was interesting this past week. On the same day that we put a rover on Mars, we can't keep the power on in Texas. I think there's a lesson there. And I think it's kind of ironic that the primary power source to get the rover to Mars is fossil fuel, kerosene. That's what powers the rockets, both the launch rocket and the reentry counterburn rockets. When this rover gets to Mars and needs to slow its reentry into the Mars atmosphere, fossil fuels, it's still a superior power source. It's portable, it's self-contained. And Texas is not in a bad spot. You see what's going on in Texas and it's just terrible, but Texas is not in a bad spot because of the weather. Texas is in a bad spot because of politically motivated decisions, not economically vetted decisions. Down in Texas, what started the brownouts was that their turbines froze up, their wind turbines froze up. When those froze up, the power grid couldn't handle the power needs. then they had to start doing rolling blackouts. Once you have rolling blackouts, houses weren't getting heated. People were getting cold. Pipes were freezing. It just all spiraled. But Texas wasn't in a bad spot because of the weather. Texas was in a bad spot because of politically motivated decisions. Look, wind power wasn't the most economically viable solution down in Texas. It wasn't. I'll give you an example here locally. In New Berlin, there's a new subdivision called Red Fox Crossing. It's a solar development. Every house has solar panels. And I drove by the other day on the way home from the gym, and there's like 12 inches of snow on every roof in that subdivision. And there's two things that made Red Fox Crossing viable, this solar-powered subdivision. And the two things that made Red Fox Crossing viable were tax incentives and the existing power grid. Those houses in Red Fox Crossing in New Berlin would not have been built with solar panels except for the tax rebates the government gives for solar power. It just wouldn't have made sense. It's a Newman development. Remember that the next time that Mark Newman runs for office. It's not a slam. I like Mark Newman, but just a fact. The Newman family has conflicts of interest. They make millions and millions and millions of dollars off of solar tax credits. The company's called Sunvest Solar. You can Google it. Sunvest Solar Newman, N-E-U-M-A-N-N. Matt Newman is Mark Newman's son. He's the head of it. But their business has just skyrocketed, and it's all because of the tax policy. He's even said it. He goes on and says it. He goes on to interviews and says it's because of the tax policy that their business grew, you know, by hundreds of millions of dollars. But those homes could not have been built without the tax incentives. They just wouldn't have made sense financially to pay for the cost of solar panels. Yeah, it wouldn't have made sense. But they could also not have been built without the power grid. Because in the summer, these houses down at Red Fox Crossing, they sell electricity back to the grid. But in the winter, they need power from the grid. If every home in New Berlin went solar, they'll need the exact same power grid, the exact same power producing capacity that you have now, because you need every power station, every power plant, because you have to meet peak demand. Your power system is worthless if you can't meet peak demand. You can manufacture widgets. You can produce widgets in the off season. You can produce more in the slow season. You can store them in a warehouse, and then you can sell them during the busy season. But you can't do that with power. Power, you have to generate it when you need it. And when roofs are covered in snow and it's 5 degrees, you need all of the capacity of the power grid here in Wisconsin. I don't know when peak demand is for power in Wisconsin, if it's during the summer when all the air conditionings are running or during the winter when all the heaters are running. But in Wisconsin, at some point, everybody needs the power grid. And so that's peak demand, as if you had no solar panels. So it's not like if you put solar panels in every house, you can get rid of some power plants because you won't need them. No, you're still going to need those power plants. You're still going to need those power plants to be viable. Oh, shit. I've only got 90 seconds left in the show. So we're probably going to finish the last part on podcast here. So my live listeners, Zach, Lon, Ralph, and whoever else is listening live, thanks for tuning in. I'm going to keep going here for a couple minutes and finish up this topic so you can catch it on the podcast. The live feed is going to get cut off here in 60 seconds, but the podcast will have the rest if you want to catch this last little bit. But anyway, so every house in New Berlin, if you put solar panels on it, you can't then turn around and get rid of a couple power plants and not have to spend the money to maintain those power plants. You still need those because in the winter when we have peak demand season, for power, you're going to need all that capacity of those power plants. So this, if you understand economics, and 90% of politicians do not, you'd see that there's no economic viability with power right now. So certainly not in Wisconsin. It's just a novelty propped up by tax rebates. And the real viable power source, power plants, that's what allows this novelty of solar power to exist in Wisconsin. If we didn't have all these power plants in Wisconsin, the solar power homes wouldn't be viable because they need power. And our country, it's just, we keep working ourselves into bad spots because of politically driven decisions. And we let politics and irrational dream wishes rule the day instead of economic realities. Again, we can stick a rover on Mars, but we can't keep the power on in Texas. You kidding me? We could totally keep the power on in Texas if we just didn't make stupid decisions motivated by non-economically viable fantasies. The fact that the wind power was so much of a portion of the power grid in Texas, that was a huge mistake. And I guarantee it wasn't economically viable. But just a huge mistake. And again, we keep doing this kind of stuff in this country. The problems in this country are self-imposed. That's why Trump could turn the economy into just the greatest economy this country has had in almost forever. I mean, probably since before the Great Depression, when the Raw Deal hit, called the New Deal. Because government policy is the reason why we have problems. You look at just about every issue that's facing this country. It's driven. It's a self-initiated problem. Crime, totally a result of government policy. Poverty, totally a result of government policy. And those two things actually go into play. I'll give you an example of crime. When you have women who get paid money to have kids by the government, they don't need the dad around, they aren't as judicious with who they spread their legs for lack of a more politically polished way of saying that. If it was tough to be, and it is tough to be a single mom, but if it was really tough, like example, you don't get money from the government for being a single mom. Right now, you're a single mom, boom, money from the government, unless you're very wealthy. But you know, you're 21 years old, 22 years old, you get pregnant, single mom. I mean, you don't probably don't have a well-paying job. You're going to get money from the government as a single mom. So when you get money from the government for having kids, you don't need to keep the dad around. You might not even want. And then when you don't have dads around, you don't have father figures, and then you get crime. So again, even crime is caused by government policy. Now, there's other ways crime causes government policy. Example, people commit a crime. The DA plea bargains down to a misdemeanor. You know, people steal a car, they plea bargain down to misdemeanor, no jail, no punishment, no nothing. There's no deterrent. You get more crime. So again, government policy. All these problems in this country could be fixed if government just got out of the way and stopped doing coronavirus. If government just got out of the way, this thing would remedy itself. But anyway, that's why we can't have nice things in this country, because people just want to, you know, these liberals think that they can just wave their magic wand and have this utopia and start forcing the things that they want, even though those things don't make sense. And then you get what you got in Texas. So anyway, that's the show for this week. Hope you guys enjoyed it. I think the weather's supposed to be turning warm, so maybe we're kind of turning the cover here on winter come spring. It's supposed to be warm up next week, so had a couple other topics tonight, but I'm just going to save those. I think I only had one other topic I didn't get to. No, I had two. Two topics I didn't get to tonight, but thank you guys for tuning in. Hope you guys have a great week. Carry on. Be well armed.
Sniper Chick Julie. You've been listening to Well Armed Radio, and I have to know, is that a gun in your pants, or did you just really enjoy the show?
Stop listening to the bombastic loudmouths on the radio and television and the internet. To hell with them.